Hi, my name's Chris Scott, and this interview was recorded for the UK Wine Show. For the latest news and terms and conditions, go to ukwineshow.co.uk. Hi, my name's Chris Scott, and I'm here with Ben Witchell from St Vineyards up here in, well, I think you call it East Anglia, is that right?
Yeah, East Anglia is the name for the region, but yeah, we're just on the border of Norfolk and Suffolk. We're just into Norfolk, so where we're looking now out of the tasting room, we can actually see Suffolk. So, technically in Norfolk there.
Okay. Well, all I can tell you is it's very cold today.
It is chilly. Yeah. Now we've had some nice frosts. It's pretty good for the vineyard at this time of year. I'm not worried. If it was spring, I'd be a little bit more worried. But quite happy with frost now. But no, a lovely clear day. Be going out doing some pruning later. So it's nice when there's some sun to do some pruning.
Winter pruning, the worst job in the world, as far as I'm concerned.
There's worse. There are worse.
Really?
Yeah, oh yeah. Bud rubbing is worse.
But you can do that in spring, though, when it's warmer.
That's true. You do it at warmer time of year, but it's just as back-breaking.
We were in your winery earlier, and you're doing some cold stabilisation of some of your wines.
Yeah, that's right.
And what are you doing? Heating it up to get it cold enough so it's not too cold, or
no.
Feels like it.
Yeah, no, we're having to heat the tanks actually to get them. Yeah, that's right. No, I wish. No, I mean, that's the good thing about this time of year is that the natural ambient temperature outside helps reduce the energy costs. So it's a great time of year. So I'm very happy that it's sort of, I think the ambient temperature of an empty tank in the winery was about -2 this morning. Mm-hmm. The ambient temperature of the tanks that we're putting through cold stabilization at the moment is about -4, -4.5, something like that.
Yeah, yeah.
And we'll keep them at that temperature for about a week. And then we'll test for the cold stability.
And we're not really going to cover that, but since we raised it, cold stabilization, what's the purpose of it?
It's basically just to force out all of the potassium bitartrate crystals that are naturally formed in wine through a reaction between potassium and tartaric acid, and they're cold unstable, so they tend to sort of precipitate and fall out of wines at cold temperature. So and they appear in white wine to be sort of like almost like glass crystals.
Yeah, yeah, wine diamonds. Some people.
Yeah, so you know, in some wines they're considered to be a sign that the wine has not been tampered with, but in other wines, particularly like sparkling wine, they're a complete no-no because they can interfere with the carbonation.
Yeah, yeah.
And also with the presentation of the bottle. So we do a natural process of stabilising for those. As I said, they fall out of the wine naturally at cold temperatures, so that's why you shouldn't really keep a bottle of white wine in the fridge for too long at the back of the fridge. So we just crash chill the wines down to about -4 for about a week, and then that drops the crystals out naturally.
Yeah, and then you don't have to worry about them later on.
And then the wine is stable.
Okay, so how do we look in your winery? We interviewed you almost 2 years ago. We released the show in 2016, April 2016.
Yes.
And at that stage you were, I'm going to build a winery, I'm going to plant some vineyards, I'm going to do this.
Yeah.
This is what I'm going to do.
It's all a dream, yeah.
And 2 years later, you've done some of it.
Yes. No, we have. No, I mean, it's been a long 2 years, quite a stressful, worrying 2 years. But it's been good. Yeah, as you see, we've converted 2 grain stores. One of the grain stores is a winery where we've got a lot of stainless steel tanks now. We've got another grain store which is converted into a cellar room.
You sure it's not a beer room?
There is some beer in there as well. Yeah, I'll drop in. Yeah, we've got a brewery on site called Ampersand Brew Company, who's the son of my business partner, who's the farmer here, making some lovely craft beer. So yeah, that's actually quite handy having a brewer close by, someone to share sort of stories with. There are various synergies between beer and wine, so it's quite nice.
Yeah, but normally most people don't want any wine after a load of tastings, and a beer is perfect. So
yeah, that's true. It's nice at the end of a long day to have a cold beer.
Yeah.
So no, that's been pretty good. But we've got all of the equipment. So we've got the inert gas press, which I talked to you about before. We've got everything fully temperature controlled, which we installed ourselves. We've got inert gas storage capabilities, so we have a positive pressure system, which is sort of quite common in the new world, where you can apply a positive pressure of an inert gas like nitrogen onto the tops of the tanks.
And that stops oxygen.
That basically prevents oxygen, so you can completely inert a tank before you fill it. What you do is you fill the tank up with water.
Water.
Yep. So you fill the tank up with water, and then you drain the tank. You drain the water away. You save it in another tank so you can use it multiple times. You drain the water, but as the water's draining, you open the nitrogen valve on the top of the tank so it backfills with nitrogen.
Okay.
And then you know that as you've emptied that tank, that the only thing in that tank is nitrogen.
Yeah.
You can do various tests on that to test the atmospheric oxygen in the tank, but it's the only sort of sure way of getting a tank full of nitrogen. So you then have your tank full of nitrogen, and it's under a positive pressure nitrogen.
You say positive pressure, you mean it's just slightly higher pressure than atmosphere?
It's slightly lower pressure than atmosphere. It's slightly higher pressure than atmosphere.
Yeah, so if there's a leak, it just comes out as opposed to something going in.
Yes, that's right. The tank is vented so that it can just take a small amount of pressure, but it's not like a beer tank that you can pressurise up to sort of carbonation kind of pressures.
Yeah, yep.
And then basically, so the tank's full of a light pressure of nitrogen, and then we just then can fill it with the wine or the juice, and then you know that juice is completely free of any kind of oxygen.
And why do you want to keep it away from oxygen?
We're making quite aromatic styles of wine in England, and we're working with varieties like Bacchus that are very aromatic styles of wine, and so. The use of inert gas, I think, is very interesting when you're handling aromatic styles of wine, because a lot of the aroma compounds that you're getting, particularly through the fermentation process, sort of fermentation esters and terpenes, they could be quite volatile. And so we're just trying to do as much as we can to protect the wine throughout its whole process. So we have actually got the ability to use inert gas and do quite a reductive style of winemaking from the very beginning. Yeah.
Okay, so by keeping the wine away from oxygen, some of those more volatile aromas don't...
There's less chance of them getting in contact with oxygen and to be degraded through sort of oxidation. I mean, there are counter-arguments for and against sort of reductive-style winemaking.
They don't tend to age?
They don't tend to age as well, because they can be a little less less stable to sort of long-term oxidation.
Mm-hmm.
Because as well as when you're protecting your wine... From oxidation, you're also protecting some of the polyphenols in the wine, and polyphenols can actually be a catalyst for oxidation. So conversely, by protecting your wine from oxidation, you're actually retaining some of the oxidizable compounds in the wine, meaning that if you do use a reductive winemaking technique, you have to be very, very sure that right up until bottling, you're allowing less oxygen into that wine, because you've potentially got a less stable wine. But
it's not as
clear cut as that.
I didn't quite follow that. Let's just back up a little bit. Sorry about that.
No, that's fine, yeah.
So you are making a wine without oxygen and it doesn't produce polyphenols? Because polyphenols are just like tannins and colour and all that, and flavour.
That's right, yeah. Polyphenols are antioxidants.
Yep.
But they're also pro-oxidants.
Okay, because I always think of them as antioxidants.
Yeah, they can act in both ways. But basically, most chemical oxidation in wine happens due to the interaction of polyphenols and metals like copper and iron, which are naturally present at low levels. So if you've got larger amounts of polyphenols in a wine, there are more catalysts for chemical oxidation, which will ultimately lead to acetaldehyde, which is the sherry flavour that you get from chemical oxidation of ethanol. So by pressing under inert gas, you are creating a risk of retaining more of those polyphenols, which are oxidation catalysts. And so therefore, you potentially have a less stable wine with regard to oxidation.
Yep.
So you have to be much more sure that the remainder of your winemaking process before you get it in a bottle is free from oxygen as well.
Mm-hmm.
But it's not just as straightforward as that, because by protecting your wine from oxidation, you've also got other antioxidants that you do protect, things like glutathione, which have been potentially said to sort of almost replace sulfur dioxide. So it's not quite as simple as that. And I think oxidation in wine is a very, very complicated area, and I don't pretend to understand much about it at all. But the reason we have an inert gas press is because we want to be able to experiment with using inert gases. But the great thing about an inert gas press is that you can also use it conventionally. So if I want to, particularly for champagne styles, I won't be pressing under inert gas. I will just do the standard press, and then the juice falls out of the press straight into a drip tray, and it is actually saturated with oxygen at that point.
Yeah.
Because for champagne styles of wine, you don't typically want to do an inert gas style pressing.
Okay, so let's talk we're starting to talk.
Yeah,
we're almost finished the show, and
have another flapjack, Chris.
Yeah, I will. We haven't even started talking about what I want to talk about. A couple of things about your winery. We'll just talk about the things I noticed about it. Anyway, I saw the inert tank. Lots of smaller tanks. There's no like some wineries have just huge tanks. Mm. Yours are. There's a couple of decent middle-sized tanks, but generally they're quite piddly little tanks.
Yeah, yeah, they are. I wouldn't describe them as piddly. That's quite all right. No, yeah, you're right. I mean, we are a small winery, so we don't have the need for sort of 50,000 litre tanks at the moment or anything like that. But our largest tank at the moment is about 3,000 litres, and that's 4,000 bottles, which represents our largest blend. So the Bacchus that we're going to release is going to be about 4,000 bottles. We've got a mixture of tanks ranging from sort of 500 litres through to 1,000, 1,500, 2,000, 3,000 litre tanks. And we're also working with barrels as well, which are 225 litres. And the reason I like using small tanks is because what we try and do with the grapes as they arrive at the winery is treat them as differently as we can. So with the Bacchus, we pick some of the Bacchus a little bit early, and we tend to get a slightly less ripe Bacchus from some of the vineyards in Norfolk, where we source some of our grapes from. And then we'll pick Bacchus a bit later and pick from Essex, where we'll get an overripe Bacchus. And we'll treat those differently. So we'll do some of that inert gas pressed, some of it conventional, some of it crushed destemmed, some of it whole bunch pressed, fermented at different temperatures, fermented with different yeast strains. And you need a lot of tanks in order to have those variables being played out. You could just blend them into one tank, but with the Bacchus, what I'm trying to do is put together a series of sort of individual component wines. So the Bacchus that you just tried was actually blended from six fermentations that were blended especially to make that blend. And each of those fermentations, some of them would have been crushed destemmed, some of them would have been a whole bunch pressed, some of them would have used a kind of terpene expressing yeast strain, others a thiol expressing yeast strain, and some would have been fermented slightly warmer. And the idea is that as a winemaker, you give yourself as many possible building blocks as possible so that you've got a nice job at the end to sort of try and blend something a bit more interesting.
Okay, so that's the reason why you've got your different tanks.
Yeah, yeah, basically, yeah. Long answer, sorry.
No, that's all right, And so this is, let's just touch on, you've got a vineyard planted now. You've got two vineyards.
Yeah.
Apparently, with that planted. I saw one
where
they were quite young. But you haven't had any fruit off your own vineyards.
No.
But you released some wines.
Yeah.
2016. Well, you got 2016 vintage. So
yeah.
What happened there?
So we're working with growers across East Anglia. So we want to keep everything to East Anglian growers. And we're sourcing grapes from Norfolk and Essex at the moment.
Mm-hmm.
So in 2016, we worked with a really lovely vineyard called Great Whitman's, and they're contract growers, and they supply a lot of wineries throughout England, actually. And we sourced from them.
They don't have their own wine making facilities and their own brand.
No, they purely just grow grapes.
Why did they do that?
Because they're a big farm, and you know they've got an arable farm there as well. They're just huge farmers, and so they've got no desire really to make their own wine, I don't think.
Mm-hmm.
So they sort of diversified and planted, about 30 hectares of vines. So they supply various different wineries across England. And we were one of those in 2016. And from them we took Bacchus and Pinot Blanc. So the Bacchus we got was lovely and ripe. And we made a Bacchus from that, which did very well. That won the East Anglian Wine of the Year.
Mm-hmm.
And that also, it got commended at the International Wine Challenge and also got a medal at the Nationals. And we also made a Pinot Blanc. And the interesting thing about the Pinot Blanc was that Pinot Blanc is a bit more of a marginal variety in England. It doesn't ripen quite so readily as Bacchus. It tends to be used as a sparkling base wine, a bit more like Chardonnay.
Mm-hmm.
This is quite similar in character to Chardonnay. But we managed to actually get some very ripe Pinot Blanc because we noticed for this particular plot, the rows are actually sort of facing east-west, so actually one side of the canopy sort of had a more southerly aspect, and that was a lot riper than the northerly aspect. So I actually, we actually only picked the grapes on the sunny side of the canopy, and they came in pretty ripe. They came in with a potential alcohol of around about just under 11%, and so we didn't have to chaptalise, and we put the wine through sort of a partial malolactic fermentation just to drop the acidity. And we made a really interesting wine from that. And that's done well. That received a silver medal and 91 points at the IWC. And No, the wines have gone well. They've all sold out. And so this year, well, sorry, 2017 for release, April 2018. Again, we work with growers in East Anglia. We work with the Norfolk Vineyard to source some Bacchus, but also some Champagne varieties, and then a couple of other varieties. Like we took some Solaris, and we also took some red varieties for a rosé. But then we also took some red Pinot Noir Precoce, which is called Frubegunda.
We'll talk about that. We're going to talk about that next week.
Okay, cool. We took some of that, and we also took some Bacchus from a vineyard down in Essex called Martin's Lane,
yep.
Which is a fantastic vineyard. Probably one of the, I think, probably one of the best vineyards.
I've heard a couple of people talk actually. About that.
No, so they're great. It's in an area of Essex called the Crouch Valley. I mean, I think East Anglia is a very promising region overall, but I think, you know, particularly around the sort of Crouch Valley area in Essex, there are a lot of growers that have been producing some consistently very, very good fruit, and they're one of them.
Okay. I forgot to mention some of our listeners are in the US and all sorts of places where
they
don't really know where we're talking about. So if you imagine England, London, if you imagine the UK and you've got London down in the bottom right-hand corner, or southeast England, as they call it, we're talking about being about 1 o'clock on the clock from London?
Yeah, something like that,
About
2 hours and a half hours drive sort of north.
At 1 o'clock?
Northeast, yeah.
Yeah, about 2 hours. I did it this morning, so yes. I know. took me an hour to get up to around the M25 and then 2 hours up from there, so yeah. One of the wines we tasted, it was a Bacchus.
Yeah.
You've held it back from your 2016 vintage.
Yeah.
But you gave it a reasonable amount of time in oak barrels.
Yeah.
And oak and Bacchus aren't really, I don't normally think of them as compatible, because I don't know, you can tell me, but I find high acid wines tend not to go particularly well with oak.
Okay.
Whites anyway.
Yeah.
If you think about it, you know, they tend not to do oak and Chablis because it's really high acidity.
Yeah.
You get into the more warmer climates or more moderate climates of Burgundy, it's okay.
Yeah.
New Zealand Sauvignon Blanc doesn't tend to take oak very well.
No.
Yeah, because it's a high acid. Well, I can't really think of a white wine that's really high acid that has oak.
Yeah,
but you've given it a slab on your 2016.
Yeah. We've given it a bit of a go. I mean, you're right. I mean, I think high acid wines, acids, and sort of tannins in combination can obviously highlight each other.
Yeah.
So that tends to happen. But we had some Bacchus that we were quite pleased with in 2016, and knowing that Bacchus is quite an interesting variety from an aromatic perspective, quite close to Riesling, just thought it'd be quite interesting just to see what happened over the course of a year. So we actually transferred it to three-year-old barrels that we sourced directly from Puy Frise.
So three-year-old barrels aren't new. So they've given up a lot of their flavour already.
Yeah, they have. So they would have been used for, they would have had three fills, three full seasons in Puy Frise. So there would be natural sort of tartrate deposits on the inside. They would have lost some of their porosity and obviously lost some of the toasty sort of oak characteristics from the staves. So they do become a bit more of a neutral barrel. So I mean, that's where we source all of our barrels. We source them from an estate in Moulin-Avant, and their red barrels are from Moulin-Avant, their white barrels are from Puy Frise.
Yeah, Moulin-Avant in Beaujolais, yeah?
Yeah, that's right, one of the Cru villages that is making more of the sort of oak-driven wines down there. Obviously, Puy Frise making very oaky wines. We source our barrels from them, and I've been very pleased with the results. And with the Pinot Blanc, we did do a sort of partial oak aging, and with the reds, we're using that. And I think a neutral barrel is working really nicely. As you say, with the Bacchus, and the idea behind it being quite a close variety to Riesling is that, you know, with aged Riesling, it does start to develop sort of petrol-like characteristics. Some of those sort of terpenes become dumbed down a bit, and you get more of the sort of carotenoid sort of style aromas, that sort of petrolite sort of thing coming out. And I just thought it'd be interesting to give that a go. And I think what we've got, we've got something that does have quite an oak-driven flavour to it, but it's quite complex. It does have that sort of characteristic of you were saying it's kind of like a sort of pears.
I thought
it was like a sort of frangipane, sort of petroly, kind of lemon peel. Certainly very interesting, and it's really different to the Bacchus that most people are used to drinking, which is quite citrusy, elderflower, and quite crisp and fresh. So the idea behind that wine is something we're doing, just limited release wines through a little membership club we've got called the Venn Club, where people can subscribe and they buy a 12-bottle case of wine every year. Six of those bottles are sort of handmade in small volumes, because you saw we had three little tanks, all 500 litres. So we're going to make about 800 bottles of those. So each Venn Club member will get two of those bottles. And the idea behind that is just do something a bit different. So, yeah. That is quite a different wine. And the other one we did, as you saw, was a Sauvignon Blanc sort of Bacchus 50-50 blend, yeah. Which again is quite unusual in England, because Sauvignon Blanc isn't really grown that widely. And when it is grown, it's often quite underripe.
Yeah.
I was quite pleased with the Sauvignon. I think we did manage to pick it quite ripe, and we've just tried, with the Venn Club, it's just about trying to make some interesting, nice wines.
Excellent.
So that was part of the reason for it, yeah.
Brilliant. All right, we're going to wrap it up there, Ben.
Cool.
Next week, I think we're going to talk about some of your grape varieties, the Solaris you mix mm-hmm. mentioned, and the
Frubigunda,
etc. So we'll explore those grape varieties, because I haven't really looked at them before.
Okay. Wow, interesting.
Yeah.